Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, what are renewables and why are media telling us so little about them? With energy prices rising and a nuclear disaster still unfolding in Japan, it would seem to be the perfect time to talk about renewable energy sources like solar, wind, and geothermal. But this hasn't been the case. Independent journalist Miranda Spencer will join us to talk about how media dismiss alternative forms of energy that are safer, cleaner, and cheaper, but apparently still less journalistically viable than petroleum, nuclear, and coal. Also on the show, the arrests of more than 100 disability rights activists on Capitol Hill protesting Republican plans for Medicaid didn't meet corporate media's standards of newsworthiness. But if news is something you haven't heard, it's hard to think what better qualifies than the potential impact of proposed budget changes on the millions of Americans with disabilities. We'll hear more about that from Mike Irvin, Chicago organizer with the disability rights group ADAPT. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press.
It's a given that media coverage of war will include some rah-rah reporting about U.S. troops, but that's nothing compared to what we've seen about the Navy SEALs in the wake of the Osama bin Laden killing. The May 3rd broadcast of ABC World News may have been the most over-the-top. Here's reporter Chris Cuomo.
You know, Diane, as impressive as the details of the bin Laden operation are, you really start to appreciate how special these SEALs are when you learn that taking out bin Laden was just another day at the office.
Of course, that's a ridiculous exaggeration unless you think Navy SEALs find and kill the world's most wanted terrorist every day. Then again, after watching ABC's report, you might get the impression that that is exactly what they do. Anchor Diane Sawyer called them a superhuman force, with Cuomo chiming in to say, a superhero has nothing on these guys, and elaborating.
You know, we keep comparing them to superheroes, but they're different from superheroes in a very important way. They're subtle. They're known for their reserved, unassuming nature, so that they carry out missions with calm. Now, Diane, why? Well, one big reason is that so the enemy does not know what it's up against until it's too late.
In the wake of an assassination that for many people around the world is a subject of controversy, ABC's question is, superheroes or better than superheroes?
The White House was pretty clear about what happened during the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound. There was a fierce firefight. Bin Laden was found crouching behind his wife. Then he resisted, possibly even reaching for a weapon. It didn't take long before the White House decided that almost none of that was true, and we started to see headlines like this creative one in the New York Times. Raid account hastily told proves fluid. The piece included a quote from a military official that there has never been any intent to deceive or dramatize. Everything we put out, we really believe to be true at the time. The official asked, quote, that he not be named because of ground rules imposed by the Department of Defense, close quote. So we never lied or exaggerated, and you can quote me on that. Just don't use my name. Well, considering the amount of revision that went on, the media seemed remarkably uninterested in demanding the White House explain themselves. Former CNN Pentagon reporter Jamie McIntyre had this to say about that on CNN's Reliable Sources.
You know, Howard, this was an avoidable misstep because anyone who's covered the military for any period of time or anyone who's briefed on military operations knows that initial details of an operation are almost always wrong.
Good to know, but maybe military reporters should consider including, along with their initial coverage of an operation, some sort of heads up to the readers about the whole almost always wrong thing.
Christian nationalist and self-styled historian David Barton is revered in conservative circles for his books and lectures claiming the U.S. was founded on Christian principles by Bible-believing men. That Barton makes his case by using fabricated, distorted, and out-of-context quotes and documents is so well known that Barton himself has admitted attributing a dozen false quotes to prominent American historical figures. For instance, for years he claimed that James Madison had said, quote, "We have staked the future of all our political institutions upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God," close quote. You'd think such a proven record of distortion would be central to reporting on Barton. So why did the front page profile of the right-wing activist in the New York Times dance around the issue? As the Times reported it, Yes, Barton had his detractors. Some historians and liberals say that he distorts things, but Barton says they distort things right back. Who's right? That's what journalism is supposed to help us decide, but reporter Eric Eckholm doesn't offer any evidence either way, preferring to play the stenographer, simply recording what the various parties say. Eckholm also fails to note Barton's controversial role in creating public school textbooks, or his links to extremists in the Christian Reconstructionist movement and the racist and anti-Semitic Christian Identity sect. Don't Times readers deserve to know that there is abundant evidence of Barton's historical distortions and that such a careless and extreme historian has a hand in creating the textbooks and curricula that their children are using in school? By reporting on a conservative icon without ferreting out basic facts, a tradition at the Times, the paper can say they covered the issue without incurring the right's anger.
The May 10th Washington Post contained a somewhat confusing report by Aaron Davis about the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq that began, quote, "The U.S.'s pleas for Iraq's government to decide within weeks whether American troops should stay beyond a year-end deadline to leave will not be met," Iraqi politicians say, complicating plans for the U.S. military withdrawal, close quote. Wait, what? If the deadline to extend U.S. troop presence is not extended, then U.S. troops have to leave, as was previously mandated. That doesn't seem too complicated. There is a political problem in Iraq in that most people don't want U.S. troops to stay, while some political leaders have hinted they might be open to an extension. But maybe readers would have been better served if the Post had started with the fifth paragraph, which reads, quote, "A growing chorus of military strategists in Washington would like a deal allowing at least some continued U.S. military presence in Iraq. Amid the broad unrest across the Middle East, they say, a U.S. foothold in Iraq is critical to help ensure stability in that country and to keep Iran and other potential aggressors in check," close quote. Well, that's a good deal clearer than referring to complications in plans for withdrawal. Readers understand, or should, that U.S. government priorities shape U.S. media coverage. If journalists aren't going to change that, they might at least be open about it.
And finally, the May 12th Washington Post had a front-page piece about Newt Gingrich's announcement that he's running for president. Reporter Dan Balls called it a milestone in presidential politics, adding that Gingrich is an idea-spewing machine, a one-man think tank, and someone who has remained in the forefront of the public policy debate over a span of decades. With his devotion to the intersection of ideas and politics, Gingrich has, quote, "kept himself in the middle of public policy debates on healthcare, education, energy, and foreign affairs," close quote. One possible downside, Balls warns, quote, "a keen intellect can also translate into the appearance of intellectual superiority," close quote. Those worried about that could fortunately refresh themselves with the same day's New York Times editorial that reminded of some of Gingrich's actual positions, like his call for a federal law to stop the imaginary takeover of the U.S. legal system by Sharia law, his concern about Obama's Kenyan anti-colonial behavior, his suggestion that opening an Islamic center in Lower Manhattan was akin to, quote, "putting a Nazi sign next to the Holocaust Museum," close quote. His view that gay rights advocates seek to impose a gay secular fascism, and that the Democrats who won office in 2008 are a secular socialist machine representing, quote, "as great a threat to America as Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union," close quote. I wonder which of those it was that Ball's worries will put people off by being too smart.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Corporate media coverage of renewable energy sources is hard to find, unless you count passing mentions of how they are too expensive or undeveloped to make much of a difference. But are these criticisms true? Are renewables really not ready for prime time? Or are there other reasons corporate media avoid open debate about these alternative energy sources? Independent journalist Miranda Spencer joins us to talk about coverage of renewables and her report, The Unrenewed Debate Over Renewable Energy, in the May edition of FAIR's magazine, Extra. Welcome back to Counterspin, Miranda Spencer.
Thank you.
Well, it would seem to be a good time to talk about alternative energy forms, no?
Yes, it would, on two fronts. One is the disaster at Fukushima a while ago with the nuclear power plants there would have been a great opportunity in the press to take another look at nuclear power. But what we saw in the first couple weeks after that happened was sort of a rush to defend nuclear power as sort of inevitable and it's safe and it couldn't happen here. And we didn't hear very much about alternative energy at all. But as you say, it is a great time to talk about it because increasingly in other parts of the press, we're seeing reports like the one that came out the other day from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change saying that it's possible by mid-century to almost completely convert to renewable power sources, something which was mainly only covered in the international press and we didn't really see much of here in the United States.
Yes, we saw that report in The Guardian. It was about how the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said 80% could be covered by renewables by, as you say, mid-century. There are other experts, of course. Arjun Makajani has a whole book on this. He's a former nuclear engineer. He is a nuclear engineer and an electrical engineer. So there's no shortage of that. You took a look at the coverage and noted several things about it, among them that renewables were missing. But you also noted in the coverage that when people criticized nuclear in the wake of the Fukushima disaster, they were often portrayed as advocates of coal.
It wasn't quite like that. It was more that when people raised the idea that there was an alternative to nuclear, the alternative was suggested, well, the only other alternatives we really have are coal or imported oil, which isn't even accurate because oil is for transportation and nuclear power is for electricity. So the only alternatives that were discussed on the whole were the more conventional and polluting ones, the idea being that nuclear power is somehow more green, which isn't actually the case.
Why do you think renewables was sort of cut out of the debate or the media equation?
Well, this wasn't actually in my story, but one possible reason is that there is a huge energy lobby to Congress. For many years, there was an article in the New York Times a couple weeks after Fukushima, I should say, that detailed lobbyists' long effort to revive the nuclear industry through a big propaganda campaign and lobbying of Congress. So when the corporate media went and talked to establishment figures in the government and in industry, they basically were provided with the spin of this PR campaign that's been going on for quite some time, as documented in the New York Times.
So, Miranda, it's not that there is a lack of available advocates or experts or folks who could talk to journalists about the relevance, about, first of all, the state of renewable energy, potentially, and also about its relevance in a conversation about nuclear power, for example. It's not that those folks don't exist.
Oh, not at all. In fact, since I write for and read the so-called green press all the time, there's tons of not only people who could address that issue, but it's being reported on all the time, but just not in the corporate media. I mean, if you visit the website grist.org or, you know, read any kind of environmental reporting, it's talked about every day. It's not hidden. It's not new. Renewable energy isn't some pie in the sky in the future. It's here now, and it's growing.
I want to take us back just a little bit. When you reviewed coverage of renewables, what little there was, what did you find? What was the thing most typical?
Oh, well, typical frames were, as I said, this is something that's nice and could be desirable, but it's not there yet. It's not ready yet. It's too expensive. It's too complicated. It will never be reliable, all of which is debunkable. And, you know, not to necessarily be an advocate of anything in particular, but this just needs to be in the discussion as co-equal with all the other kinds of energy options, I think.
Why was this trope that, renewables aren't ready for prime time? How did that get over? Is that because of this big industry spin machine? Is it because of the experts that they go to?
I would assume so. I think also it's kind of a self-perpetuating thing that when you don't see it, you don't think about it. I'm just trying to get in the mind of the reporters. That's just not what's being talked about by the kinds of sources that they went to in the government. I mean, as I said in my analysis, most of the sources were Congress people and spokesmen from the Energy Department and so on, and they all tend to have the same view, which doesn't really focus on renewables very much. So it's kind of like it depends on who you talk to get back to what Janine said earlier.
Well, Miranda, we constantly hear that the liberal media are, for one thing, critical of industry, and also that reporters themselves tend to be pro-environmental. And yet when it comes to maybe the biggest environmental issue of the day, we find kind of a gaping absence there, a void there. I wonder, maybe just to get to you to talk some more about the alternative sources that are out there, if this is a story that corporate media are intentionally or not taking a pass on. What else do you read to learn about these things?
Well, as I say, if people are environmental reporters for the corporate media or are just talking about energy and environment in general, there's a lot of green media out there. Just off the top of my head, there is a website. Full disclosure, I recently began working part-time as a researcher. There's a website called The Daily Climate, which aggregates stories from all over the world about energy, climate, and those issues. And these are mainstream sources as well as green sources. And any reporter can go there and start reading up and finding sources from reading what other reporters have written, just as one example. As I said, grist.org is a very popular and respected environmental news website that can, you know, help give good background. But there's also trade organizations. I mean, I think reporters know how to report, so they could, you know, take a look into trade organizations for renewable, which, just in case listeners aren't familiar, are, to name three examples, wind power, solar power, and geothermal energy.
You know, there's two stories in the media that seem to be cause for celebration and positive stories about the energy outlook. One, we mentioned the IPCC report about renewables, but also the news that Japan has decided to scuttle plans for new nuclear power plants and maybe take a lead on this issue. Tell us what you can about that.
Right. Just a couple of days ago, I understand that the Japanese government decided that it was going to put a halt to new nuclear plant construction, which was a very bold move, not only because they had already laid out a plan that they were going to get, I think, 14 or 15 new ones, but the fact that it's pretty dependent on outside sources for their energy. But they have a lot of potential for geothermal there, and they decided that would be in their best interest. And so now that the Japanese government has announced that, I'm seeing more corporate media report on that. And Germany has, a few weeks ago, already took the lead on that. So I think that the conversation is now moving in that direction, but it was more generated by following the lead of the governments rather than taking an initiative to look into that.
We've been speaking with independent journalist Miranda Spencer. Her report on coverage of renewables appears in the May edition of FAIRS magazine Extra. You can find that online at FAIR.org, too. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin, Miranda Spencer.
Thanks for having me again.
In a May 10th article with the almost humorously tentative headline, critics fear GOP's proposed Medicaid changes could cut coverage for the aged, the New York Times reported concerns about the potential impact of Paul Ryan and Co.'s plans for Medicaid on the elderly, a subject a source notes has been largely unrecognized. But if the effect of possible changes to Medicaid on seniors has gotten short shrift, how much more so their effect on people with disabilities who rely on the program? That the recent Capitol Hill arrests of dozens of disability rights activists protesting the plans wasn't enough to break through to major media says something about those outlets' priorities. But then there are other purposes to activism besides making the nightly news. Our next guest was part of those D.C. protests and many others. Mike Irvin is an organizer for the national disability rights group ADAPT and one of the founders of its Chicago branch. He joins us now by phone from Chicago. Welcome to Counterspin, Mike Irvin.
Great to be here.
Well, that New York Times story reported on concerns about cuts to Medicaid. When it comes to people with disabilities who rely on Medicaid, it's cuts for sure that are a concern, but not just cuts that are the concern in the Ryan budget, as I understand it. What's at stake here?
Well, in the short term, specifically on the Ryan budget, one, it's cuts, yes. And there's simple math there. You just can't take billions of dollars from a program and say it's not going to hurt anybody. That's just nonsense. And if you can add two and two, you can realize that that just doesn't work. And also, the attempt to block grant Medicaid would be a huge fundamental change in what Medicaid really is. Right now, the way it's designed is that the program fits needs. If people need a certain amount of benefit under Medicaid, the program pays for it. Block grant would make it the other way around. It would make your needs have to fit the money. And it would give states only so much money, and they call it flexibility, but we say it's flexibility in the same sense that Jim Crow gave states flexibility to decide who gets a drink out of their water fountain. We think that it would just be used as an excuse to drop people, especially those of us with more significant disabilities who cost more money. And so not only the cutting, but the whole idea of block granting is what created us so much that it made us come to the Capitol.
Well, you have talked about an institutional bias in the Medicaid program. What are you talking about there? What is that institutional bias?
Institutional bias in Medicaid simply means that the way Medicaid law is written, if you are a person with a disability or someone who's otherwise qualified for Medicaid and you need long-term care, as I do, I use a motorized wheelchair, someone comes into my home and helps me every day, the states are required to pay for it if it's in a nursing home. And so you have to go to a nursing home. But if you want to be in your home, you cannot say, I want that same Medicaid money to pay for me to be in my home. That is optional. And that's what the institutional bias of Medicaid is. Our group ADAPT, through the law that we have tried to get passed called the Community Choice Act, through the Community First Choice Option, which was part of the health care reform bill, trying to get that changed so that if you want to get assistance in your home, you can do that, try to get that institutional bias removed. It makes no sense. It's there because the nursing home lobby is powerful and wants it to be there. It costs more, and it's more impractical on every level to put people in institutions. But those laws were written a long time ago, and that lobby doesn't want to see them changed.
Well, you are a journalist. I wonder what you make overall of the visibility of issues of particular concern to people with disabilities in media's budget coverage.
I think media misses this issue. This is a very important issue for everybody, because everybody is going to face their at some point in their life when they or someone very important to them needs some kind of extra help. I mean, of course, we all get help with things every day. Nobody does everything themselves, but this kind of what we consider in this society to be extraordinary help, someone to help you get in and out of bed every day or something like that. Everybody's going to face that in their life at some point. And we're trying to make it so that that isn't a traumatic decision, that you can say, I just want to get help in my home and stay in my home and not miss a beat. The media, I think, looks at it as something where there is no choice, that when you reach that stage in life, a nursing home is really all there is, and it's really a shame, but that's how it is, and I don't think they see a story there. I don't think that they realize the possibilities beyond that, and so therefore they just see it as, I'm not quite sure why they dismiss it, but they dismiss it as something that's of a little importance to just a few people.
Well, another thing or tendency we sort of see in big media is a tendency to sort of sniff at activism, at least usually. But you can attest to the power of frontline activism of the sort that ADAPT activists were just arrested for on Capitol Hill, can't you? That activism actually makes change.
It does. Well, as I mentioned, the Community First Choice Option, which allows states more ability to choose to keep people in their homes and getting extra money, was part of the health care reform bill. There's a program called Money Follows the Person through the Department of, through CMS and the federal government, which states can use to get millions of dollars to help people transition out of nursing homes and into their homes. And those are all directly because of ADAPT protests. And so, you know, we feel that, I mean, billions of dollars are shifted away from institutional care into community care. I think the other thing the media misses is the big business of this. I don't think that they look at all into the big, powerful industry that nursing homes are. I think they see them as benevolent care institutions when, in fact, they are a big business that really uses us as their money source and wants to keep it that way. We are a commodity to that industry.
Well, I'll take you back finally to that New York Times story I started with, because at one point when they are trying to spell out their concerns, they in fact refer to the concerns as being over cuts to, quote, spending for nursing home care, close quote. Talking to you is telling me that that is not the only or the best way for reporters to think about it. And maybe you could close by telling us, you know, ADAPT called their recent D.C. actions defunding our freedom. That's a much different angle on it than saying what we should be concerned about is just cuts to nursing homes.
Right. Well, by defunding our freedom, we mean that our freedom, literally for millions and millions and millions of people with disabilities, our freedom literally depends on Medicaid to pay for the services we get in our homes. I use a motorized wheelchair. Someone comes into my home every day. Someone I choose, hire and fire myself and direct myself, gets me out of bed, gets me dressed, got me set up to talk to you here today. Without Medicaid, that doesn't happen. We end up going to nursing homes. To us, that's like being incarcerated, and it's literally a loss of freedom. And that's why it's such a monumental issue to us.
We've been speaking with Mike Irvin, Chicago organizer with the group ADAPT. Find out more about that group and their work online at adapt.org. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin, Mike Irvin.
Thanks for your interest.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. You can also find subscription information on FAIR's website. It's FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.